So God calls a meeting in his office. And to this meeting, he invites Linnaeus, the father of modern classification, the guy who came up with all the Latin terms that we had to memorize in high school biology, Melville Dewey, and Penny, director of a small rural library who decide to meet people. And he says to them, he says, thanks for coming. He says, I did it. I pulled the trigger. I called the raptor, brought all the souls up from Earth, and packed it all in that room behind that door. But now I've got a problem. He said, the problem is when I came up with this idea, like humans were talking hundreds of millions, and now you guys have been busy, and you got billions going on, and frankly, I just don't know how to sort through them to figure out who's going to be saved and who's going to be in.
Linnaeus says, no problem, I'm on it. Walks through the door. Hour goes by.
2 hours. 3 hours.
5 hours later, Linnaeus crawls out of the door, covered in sweat, torn clothing, and says, forget it, I couldn't do it.
Says, you know, I was doing fine until I found, like, the steampunk teenage Japanese guy, and I just could not find a Latin word. I ran out of Latin.
So Dewey, being the humble person he is, says, no problem. Runs through the door.
Hour, 2 hours, 7 hours later, Melville comes out. Just covered in sweat. Just absolutely defeated. What little hair he has left must. And says, forget it.
He says, I was doing fine when I got like 300 Christian sects all organized, and then I ran into like a Jewish guy and two Muslims, and I ran out of numbers.
That's a cataloging joke for those of you who've got that.
At which point, Penny spins on her heels, walks right to the door, 2 minutes later, walks out of the door, says, no.
And God says, that's great, but how did you do it? She goes, actually, it was really simple. What I did was I asked everyone in the room to raise their hands if they had ever voted to increase library funding, and the rest I told could go to hell. Now, that joke has absolutely nothing to do with my presentation today, other than to kiss up to you as I ruin the rest of it. But it's sort of interesting note about sort of when we look to our tools to apply them to different situations, sometimes we need to take a whole different standpoint. Now, this is the problem when you come up with titles and you give presentations, which is they usually want to know them more than a day ahead. And so you give them a title, and there it is. And it's a good title, and I think it's appropriate. But actually, I think a more appropriate title for my theme of my talk today is actually this. A time of our choosing. These are times of change. And oftentimes, we as librarians can look at that, and we can find it as a very stressful occurrence. We can find it that we feel like we are victims to the change through larger forces around us, and we can feel somewhat powerless in the midst of that change. But I want to say that I believe today that our future is in our hands. I further believe that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us, not behind us. That together, we can bring libraries back to the center of our communities. Whether those communities be academic communities, whether they be physical-based communities, whether they be school communities, whether they be communities of interest or corporations, I believe that the folks here can do that. This is not a task for the next generation librarians, or the last generation librarians, or the new librarians, or the young librarians, or the old librarians, or whatever. This is a task for all of us. We are the foot soldiers on a mission to re-stimulate, revitalize, and rethink librarians. We need to believe that we can bring about the new golden age of librarianship. That someday, in the far future, people will go, hey, library about fingers. Did you see what they did in Michigan? That's where we need to get. But we're not going to do it by constantly running on a treadmill after the new thing, the new technology, the new problem. We need to step back and think about what we're doing. And so my theme today, what I want to talk about is exactly that. Now, I'm not the only one who thinks this. This is Derek Law wrote in a recent discussion about the future of academic libraries. And he said, librarians have become so busy and adept at keeping the library efficient and well-managed that we have lacked the space to step back and observe it from a higher level. Now, whatever you think about good old Melville,
I got to be careful talking about sort of professor librarians from upstate New York, with not a lot of hair.
I think that one of the great disservices he did to the library profession is that he made efficiency a core objective of librarians. That, in fact, what happens is we would begin to stress standardization and global solutions to the messiness of the world around us. And as this world has gotten messier, and as the options and technologies and communities and variety of communities and scope of access have changed, we have not looked and said, wait a minute, maybe one size fits all doesn't work so well. And we need to look at how we can customize the solution. And in doing so, we need to look at what does that do to change us as librarians. Now let me give you the other side of this equation. That today, unless I slip off, and I will, I want to talk about librarians. Because unlike other people who feel that that librarians were named after the buildings we work in, I'm pretty sure they named the building after us. The true value moving forward of libraries is you. It's not your collections, it's not your shelves, it's not your books, it's not your tablet. These things are tools. But in much the same way that we misassociate things like dentists with drills, we misassociate librarians with books. They're tools. Think about it. When does a dentist use a drill? When he's failed. When the situation is not beyond, or when it's necessary. But the point is, if he does his job really well, no one walks out going, boy, that dentist did a great job not drilling my teeth. Right? We pat ourselves on the back. Boy, what do you think I brushed the floss? So, what is our contribution beyond the tools that we can bring? The books are important. Catalogs, not so important, but we have to. The idea is that these are tools, and we are the value that we bring to it. So, I want to look then at stepping back. Now, I'll tell you, not everyone feels this is a necessary step. If you haven't done it yet, I'm sure it's coming up, right? There's been a spike in usage, particularly in public libraries, right? If this is just a simple Google search, increased public library usage is everywhere. My guess is some paper somewhere around here has written the equivalent. Luckily, they also write the dot, 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 and you're taking away the resources to handle it. But the point is that we have a spike in usage. Rahm Emanuel's quote about a crisis is a terrible thing to waste, right? We've done that, right? It's great. We're mean darlings.
We're back tonight with our in-depth report. These tough economic times, as we've been saying, have forced a lot of people to find new ways of doing things to save money. And listen to this next one. With money so tight, the cost of books has people turning to a place where you can actually get books free, then return them for the next user. The library business, it seems, is booming.
As stores try everything they can to get shoppers to pry open their wallets, there is one place that's hotter than ever, believe it or not, your local library. Americans are saving money by borrowing books, CDs, and DVDs instead of buying them. Borrowing is up 35% over last year in Chicago and 16% in New York, while bookstores have seen sales dry up. Barnes & Noble.
So, by the way, the last part was dropped. So we're not buying. Why are we even here? We're doing stuff. Right? We know that the library usage is on the rise. We can look at lots of different statistics. And the other thing is, not only do we have plenty of people to deal with, because that's going well. Who's having conversations about libraries going away? But we're busy on other stuff. We know what we're supposed to do, right? We're working in Dublin Core. And, Dublin Core becomes a little cliche on the research side.
You always have the semantic web.
And the semantic web, you know it's semantic because it has lines and circles. And so, don't bother me. I have to worry about web services, and I have to worry about integrating APIs. And if I need reference, there's no one to need reference out. Boy, I have to figure out this. Do I use question point? Do I use instant messaging? Do I use email still? How do I build a system to do this? And what about the knowledge base? And of course, if we have any spare time, spare neurons around, there are a few social network sites that we have. We were just having a Facebook conversation here. And I think, it's like, well,
but yes, my Facebook's going well. How is your
3,000 other ones that I've got to check on and so on, right? So don't bother me. As librarians, we're doing just fine. And we have plenty of ability. Why step back? Why take a look and become more reflective in practice? Well, What I want to do is I want to warn you around what I call a functional approach to librarianship. If you ask many librarians, if you ask them,
what do you do? The answer will often turn into what they actually procedurally do. I catalog, I reference, I organize.
In fact, what's interesting is it's oftentimes easier to have librarians answer the question, what do you do, than what value do you bring? And that scares me a lot. I've been in many situations where I talk to librarians. Now, the records,
we have to get our speeches correct. But a lot of frontline librarians, you ask, what is it that you do to improve this community? The answer is I catalog and I research.
And we need to look deeper than that. Because if we stay with a functional approach, the problem is that it doesn't tell us where to go.
So I'll give you a quick example. These are two screen captures from August of 2004. The top one is Wikipedia. The bottom one is Microsoft Encarta.
In 2004, who would you have bet on to win the Encyclopedia Press?
Top one, really? You would have been alone. Or at least alone in the voice.
Because the idea, what came out was, people looked and said, they're both encyclopedias. They do the same thing. And then he said, well, how do encyclopedias work? And you say, well, they have to have content, and they have to have credibility, and they have to have this.
And Microsoft, I know we have a few school librarians, Microsoft basically owns school libraries and encyclopedias, right? They send us a CD, we put lots of CDs in the classroom. They own the passive market.
So looking at dysfunctions and who wins the encyclopedia race, one might, yes, there were people, obviously, but the point is, now the record track goes totally wrong. Open contributions, people making additions, things of that nature.
But in the time, what happened over 2004, Wikipedia took off. Microsoft Encarta, I believe this month, officially takes the website off, even though they have been updating for a year.
Looking at these as functions misses the more important aspect of what's going on for their worldviews.
These two sites represent radically different worldviews. The top worldview is one of openness and contribution. The bottom one is of authority and closed making.
You see this in things like e-voting. You see this all over the place where people are building different kinds of systems.
So we have an issue, which is if we continue looking at functional views, if we define what we do by that last graph with all the pretty icons and the semantic webs, and we're looking at these things and coming up with standards,
and we look at the formalization of the task that we provide as our main activity driving forward,
we may lose the more important question about how all of this works. Now, let's take this back to the crisis of library use.
Let's dissect briefly that comment that I started with, which is, we're doing fine because the economic crisis has increased library use. That almost becomes the standard line in all media that I read. Right? Now, what's interesting is, we're happy that media is covering it. But think about for a moment, work that logic out.
Economy tanks. People come to library because it's cheap and free. Economy recovers. Do they keep coming? Do we really want to be the Walmart of the information world?
We can have readers, people who come in, you know, this is the cheap stuff, this is the good stuff, whatever it is. The other thing that's problematic about this is that it doesn't fit
well. The other problem is that we have to, if we want to increase library use again, wait for another Great Depression. That may not be a strategy, but those of you who work at Goldman Sachs, if you sabotage it again, you'll be fine.
The other problem is it's not true. This is the statistics from the state library about all public library usage in Iowa.
This is checkouts, circulation.
Notice that the line goes way up. Notice that the line starts going way up in 1998, a decade ago. You want to look at something like the actual visits, also goes up. And just because I'm here and you want to know, clearly Michigan is the exception. Nope. Here's circulation in Michigan from 98 to 2008. Pretty healthy increase. Did the economic crisis increase library usage? Yes. Was it a brand new phenomenon?
No.
For the past decade, for the past two decades, circulation has increased, visits have increased, materials have increased, How many academic libraries are sitting there going, boy, if only someone could use my online databases less? Right? How many licenses do I have to buy now? How many things? Right? How can I handle the server load?
I had a situation, the state librarian of New York happened to be speaking 2 days ago at Syracuse, and one of our faculty in one of those great sort of politically incorrect moments of those stuff, you know, I haven't been in the library in 6 months. And the question was, but have you used the library in 6 months? And the answer was yes, if you all not.
So we know that this usage thing is not here. Why are we worried about the relevancy of libraries when it goes on?
Because the truth is that if you look at what's been going on in the world, we have a lot to feel good about.
This orange line going up above the history of Apple technology is internet usage over the past 15 years.
We've dealt with a lot of crap.
We deserve a lot of credit. The truth is that libraries have survived one of the most amazing information technological explosions. We stumbled at first, we still stumble every so often, but in many ways, we've gone from the idea that the internet's where the crack is. What is it? The internet, everything on the internet's free, you get what you pay for? That attitude to, I guess we could let a few terminals in for public use, to, I guess we could let the reference libraries look at, to, if you're not on MySpace, you might as well go away as an institution. That's a free crack. And so, we have accommodated this change. Now, have we figured out the total implications of it? I would say no.
So, what I want you to think about is instead of the functions that we do, I want us to think larger, because what this graph represents is a dramatic set of opportunities. And what that previous chart represents, with all the different technologies and standards and everything that we're dealing with, represents the trees of a forest. And if we don't look up from our hidden trees and look at the new opportunities available in the forest, we may find out that we're left behind. The reason we need to step back is not because what we do is not valuable. The reason we need to step back is not because we're not, at some degree, successful in what we do. The reason we need to step back is because success does not guarantee success. You can get really good at what you do and miss the new opportunity. Microsoft was really good at encyclopedias and Carter. The reason that Microsoft failed on the web was not because they were lousy at it. It's because they kept doing what they had succeeded at and not realized the world had changed and valued things differently. So the reason we need to step back is because this is a new opportunity. So this will not be a presentation about you damn librarians don't get it.
This will not be the Google will kill us presentation. This will not be the fear and loathing in library land presentation. This is my time if people are good. Imagine what we can do next.
Thank you.
I would argue that where we need to start is our mission. And here's the mission that I would like to propose for librarians. The mission of a librarian is to improve society. By the way, if you want to shorten it, stop right there. Through facilitating knowledge creation in our communities. I want you to notice a few things about this mission statement. The first is, it is not the mission of a library. A library is some org chart. A library may be a building. A library may be a budget line somewhere, but it doesn't do anything. Librarians do things. There was the Darien statement on libraries talk about the libraries
being eternal and librarians are stewards of it. Forget it. No. They got that backwards.
Libraries go away, you guys don't. Period. Enough said. What do you call a room full of books?
A closet.
What do you call an empty room with a librarian in it? A library. Because within 10 minutes, if there's an internet connection, within 5 minutes, there will be collections, there will be services, people will be out there seeking information, how will they provide it? It will be a living, dynamic organization. This mission is about you, not about the places you work in.
Now, the reason it's also important that it's about you is that it is your personal responsibility. You are on the line for this.
You can't sit back and say, well, I'm at the reference desk, the administration will handle that. I'm at that, someone else will handle that. You are in charge. Your work, your contributions, your ideas, your leadership is necessary. No librarian should ever be able to pass up a promotion again.
What do I mean by that? How many of you have heard me? You've been, sorry. That person who says, well, yes, they asked me to supervise this, but I really love the people at the desk, and if I supervise it, I'll lose that immediate contact. Yeah? If you don't do it because you're really good at that job, who is going to do it because they're not really good at that job? Leadership is important. Because ultimately, it's people in leadership that make librarianship happen. Back to my God analogy. God did not say, and thou shalt be library. It's not there. We made it up. We, over centuries and centuries, made up this concept. And centuries, we've changed this concept. The reason libraries exist today is not because we were unwilling to change. It was because we went through periods of dramatic and major upheavals and shifts. Can you imagine the day when they said, you know, well, we love the scrolls, but we're thinking about putting books up.
Can you roll them up?
No, they have hardcovers.
Well, we can't do hardcovers. We have tubes, and if we have books, they won't fit in the tube. No, sorry.
You know, Brian Nathan said, books are for people, you know, books are for use. If he were in Greece, he would have said scrolls are for use. I mean, I don't think he actually meant the idea that it's all about books. These periods of upheaval and shift take people to look at them, take people to change them, take dramatic action on your part. Now, this has got lots of parts to it. If you want to spend the next month and a half, I can walk you through it. Right? But I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. I want to talk about three parts of this. What do I mean by knowledge creation? What do I mean by facilitation? And what do I mean by improved society? It's a pretty big concept. And are they just what we did all along, or are they new? So, let's start with knowledge. And the best way for me to explain knowledge is to basically show you a rock. There's a rock. You may know this rock. This is Ayers Mountain in Australia. Now, the reason I bring up this rock is that I would like us all now, for once and for all, to bury the following phrase. Recorded knowledge. You can't do it. It's like talking about intelligent rock. It doesn't happen. Now, I look at this rock and I see, ooh, red, pretty. Right? But some people look at this rock and say, ooh, culturally significant, important to the Aborigines. Some people look at this rock and look at the geological processes by which it was produced.
Did you know Australia is the only continent without an active volcano on it? So this is not a volcanic
Now, the point is that a geologist looks at this and talks about the formation, talks about the erosion patterns, they can tell you how it was created, when it was created, all of this. The rock did not have that knowledge. The geologist brought the knowledge to the rock. A book, a page, a DVD, a CD, a Facebook entry, a tweet is not knowledge. It's a container, it's a vessel, it's something, it's an artifact of a knowledge process. And when you read it and absorb it, you are creating knowledge. And how do we do it? Well, knowledge comes from this central concept. Knowledge is created through conversation. This comes from a fellow named Gordon Cass. And Gordon Cass looked around and said, okay, I want to teach machines to think, and I'm going to use natural intelligence until artificial intelligence. And so he looked at how people learn. And what he found over and over again, that develops what we call conversation theory, is that the way people learn is through a conversation. So what is it conversation consists of? Well, the first thing it consists of is two persons, the people in the conversation. I say people, and I really should. Because let's go back to that reading. Let's grab that book. We're going to grab a book, and we're going to start reading. If I'm learning from this book, I must be engaged in a conversation, if I'm saying so. So who am I conversing with? Am I conversing with the book? The book can't talk back to me. This is like why I hate the idea of adding social tools to a catalog, because it represents books, and books aren't terribly social, in the sense that they don't sit there after hours with martinis like, boy, did you see that paper today? Maybe we should start running people who use them. Anyway. You're talking with yourself. You're not talking with the author. I mean, if you're reading The Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck's not sitting there from the grave going, good point, didn't think about that one. You're having a conversation with yourself. Think about it right now. You're having a conversation with yourself. Unless you're a student, right? You may be sitting there going, what the hell did that mean? Who are you talking to? Right? When you woke up this morning and said,
was this morning, you moved back.
Who was I talking to?
Talking to myself. It's an internal dialogue. Now, people in full libraries are used to this through concepts like critical thinking, metacognition, instructional librarian. We talk to ourselves. We literally break ourselves into and have debates amongst ourselves. We hope we don't do it out loud in public. So, it can also be between people, it can be between two groups, it can be between two companies. When your library sits there and negotiates the next contract, you're having a conversation with the vendor and your library consistently converses. But that's not enough, because what those converses are doing is they're changing language back and forth. Now, language is a funny thing.
Language comes in sort of different flavors. Think about for a moment,
it's an old joke, but I stick with it, which is, when you say catalog outside of this room, people are pretty much assuming that you're shopping at JCPenney's, right? Not, oh,
that's where I find things.
That language, how we set up a meaning number, how we can shortcut a lot of language, how we do it quickly, that language matters. This is why, for example, when you look at usage data, when people evaluate usage of library catalogs, libraries score off the charts in their ability to use them. They're efficient, fast, they're recall, decision stuff. And when you look at users, they're like below the chart, sort of passed out, not having a good day. Because think about the language you need to know to make that system work. You need to know classification language, you need to know classification, you don't need to know facets are, you need to know holdings are, you need to know all this other language.
So what language are we going to use to go back and forth? As I'm doing this, I'm trying lots of different languages.
Right? So language matters. What else? Well, what are we doing? What are these persons doing when they're changing language back and forth is they're seeking agreements. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Does that make sense to you? Does that help? What are we doing to get a reference to? Don't get any more? The agreements, by the way, the most important agreement is we agree not to agree. That's the agreement. That we've agreed that coming to this, we're not going to get consensus, so we agree to stop.
So, we seek agreements. And then, finally, it gets us to memory. We remember the agreements.
So, over time, as we approach new situations, we have all these agreements, this worldview behind us that we can bring to a new situation.
Alright? So, what I mean by knowledge creation is that this is what knowledge is. It's having conversations with ourselves, with groups. We define, we seek agreements through the use of language.
Would you and that vendor work out the contract and write the contract? That language is important, and it spends a lot of time to figure out.
We seek those agreements, and those agreements have memory. And it should be important that that memory is not a bunch of pockets in your head.
Right? Memory matters in the sense that it's relations of agreements. It's not just I need this and I need that, it's how you relate them together. Right? So the fact that, you know, Mount Everest is this high is an agreement. The fact that your plane can only go this high is an agreement. The relationship between those two matter. If you're in that plane. Alright? So, that's what we talk about knowledge. Now, what do I mean by facilitating knowledge creation? Because I said this once in the library, I said,
well, wait, now we're in the knowledge creation
business? And I said, yes.
Don't worry, you don't have to do it all yourself. Because what you're trying to do is help others do it.
So how do we facilitate? Well, if knowledge is created through conversation, then what we facilitate are conversations. We facilitate the internal dialogues, the community dialogues, the societal dialogues, the organizational dialogues, which means we need to get pretty good at conversations. For example, can you tell me what the top five conversations are in your community right now? I don't mean in your library. I don't mean at the reference desk. I don't mean in the book circulating. I mean in your community. Are you, for example, at a liberal arts college where the big question is, how do we come up with an outcomes-based approach to our liberal arts core? Right? Is it within a community we're worried about economic development issues? Is it within a school we're worried about the final exam that's coming up? What are those conversations? Are there regularities in the conversations? Where, what you, if you were to map them out, and you were to map out all your services, could you draw a line between every one of your services and one of those parts of those conversations? If not, why are we doing this? Right? That's very different than something used, something helpful. It really is a question of, does it matter? So, Let's talk about facilitation, and we're going to start with Bob. Bob will be our member today. By the way, I love the use of the word member as opposed to patron, user, or consumer. This comes from Joan Pryor Williams, who had the audacity to actually ask people what they wanted to be called in the library, and they said, we're members. We have cards. We pay tuition. We do whatever. Member. So Bob's our member, and so first thing we need to do, the first form of facilitation, is we provide access. Okay. Access to what? Well, access to other conversations, access to the artifacts of those conversations, books, CDs, webpages. But I want you to note something very important about this brief diagram. Notice that the lines have arrows at both ends. Because while the vast majority of our budgets are about access, the vast majority of our allies' education is about access. Access is an insufficient means of facilitation for knowledge. It's necessary, but insufficient. I have a 6-year-old who's in the process of learning to read. To improve his reading skills, I do not take him to a library and set him loose in the stacks and come back 2 weeks later to see how he's doing. Right? That's access, but it's not enough. Now, the other thing is the notion of agency, which is we've been spending a lot of time as librarians worried about providing access to our communities from other community stuff. I talked about it sometimes as libraries, too often we lead like this, with our back to our members. The communities are generating knowledge. The communities have desperate needs of conversations. How do we facilitate other people accessing those? We were just talking briefly about some work I've done in the Free Library of Philadelphia where we worked with the music community. And the music community, the classical music community, said, when we envision a library, public library service for professional musicians, it looks like 2 grand pianos on a stage. Because there's not enough places to perform classical music in downtown Philadelphia. When we communicate amongst ourselves and to people who appreciate it, it's through music, not through books. And what's more important is we can capture that so that people want to know what the classical musical scene of Philadelphia looks like they come to the library. Not the citizens of Philadelphia coming to the library, they can learn about it too, but people from all over the country coming to the Free Library of Philadelphia to find out about Philadelphians. What about offering blogs to your patrons? We talk about blogging a lot, it's another librarian should do it, but why don't we host it for other groups? My wife formed a mom's club. Right? So the idea was you had kids, you would stay at home moms, you would have activities, daycare efforts, all this. It started with 50 moms, it quickly grew to 300 moms. What started as living room meetings quickly became an email list where people were talking to each other. I set up their first website. They got hacked. Let me give you that again. Someone hacked the Moms Club of East Syracuse. Your website. I set up another one. They got hacked. So don't take classes from me on internet security. My point is, these groups, what they were organizing, where they were going, story time, media and library meeting places, why couldn't they organize themselves and communicate with themselves supported by the library as well? Access is not just to stuff, it's from stuff. We provide agency. I envision the day in the not too near future when librarians, academic, school, public, special are doing it. When the majority of your time each week will be spent outside of the library, within the community, producing material to distribute to other places. And our district library, anyone here from your library? 100%. Eli told me about production librarians, right? These, where, in essence, their job is to work with community members to produce materials for distribution out, correct? Cool. Right? So, the other one was, Eli was talking about a community member who said, if I can use your system to get to materials anywhere in the branches, why can't I use your system to share my own collection of materials? Why can't I put my materials in the catalogs so that people can find them and I can share? And we can truly create a community-based library, which is actually how public libraries started. So, first is access. Necessary, but insufficient. What's the other means that librarians do? We provide baseline knowledge. So think about this. There's a conversation I need to get to. Access is getting you to that conversation. Maybe it's an online discussion. Maybe it's a physical meeting that you're providing the space to. Maybe you're simply providing directions to it.
Knowledge is, once I get there, do I know what's going on? How many people are on a committee, ALA, MLA, whatever it is, that has a history of over 20 years? Seriously? A couple? How many people are pretty sure that you had to be there for the entire 20 years to know what's going on?
Right? It's a story. Everyone has a story in the workplace. They may not have the degree, but they certainly have the attitude.
They're the ones that when you raise a topic, they're sitting there like, well, what you've got to remember is...
In 1972, we tried this whole web thing. It didn't work. 1972, yes. We did it with wire and pieces of paper and clips, but it sucked bad. I'm pretty sure it got better.
So, the historians are, knowledge provides that background so when you get to the conversation, you know what's going on. Maybe it's in a different language. Maybe it's a physics conversation. It's like the idea that we provide lots of online databases now, right? Right? And is one of them Medline?
I mean, Medline's not necessarily licensed.
And so a 13-year-old comes in and asks questions about acne. Let's take him to Medline. No! He's going to get there and not know what's going on. The language used, the performance, right? So we have to understand and educate people. Joan Bechtel in the 80s said that the primary responsibility of academic librarians is to teach people scholarly communication. Not how to look something up, but literally, what are these crazy professors doing when they're writing this crap? Okay. So, we need to talk about the baseline knowledge. Boom. Bob's got knowledge. Now, the next thing we have to do is provide them a safe environment in which they can participate. So, I'm at...
Boom.
So, now I'm at the conversation. I know a little bit of what's going on, but do I feel safe participating? So I was doing a review for a faculty member, and our major criticism of this faculty member was they needed to speak up more and share their opinions. We're a faculty of one, everyone has a voice, everyone should do it. And that their answer back to me was, no. I said, what? Because every time I've done that when I first came here, the historian signed up and told me I didn't understand what was going on. They didn't feel safe. Particularly in an environment in an academic sense where there are tenured and untenured people, where the historian is someone who's going to decide their future career. How can you create a sense of safety? In public libraries, we need physical safety. We talk about kids coming after school and hating stuff. But we also need to talk about intellectual safety. We're not going to track everything you do reporting to the FBI tomorrow. We're going to allow you to look at what you need to. Right? That's a sense of safety. And lastly, we need to understand motivation better.
We need to understand what's in Bob's heart.
Why is he doing it?
Why do we care? Now, librarians have been miserable at thinking about motivation. And primarily because they've constructed the concept of library as an intrinsically motivated event.
What that means is, we sort of assume the people who walk up to our reference desk and walk through the door did it willingly. Now, all the academic reference librarians have been watching.
You're sitting there going, I remember Comp 101.
This is, so the example I give there is, you can see, this is when you torture the freshman.
You know, they have to say, I need to find articles.
On what?
And you have the assignment.
You actually have every article related to that assignment sitting behind the desk.
Oh?
Yes. What's it going to be on? It's a good thing sometimes there's only one person to reference this, or there'd be a lot of,
watch this.
Okay. Why are they there? Why should they be there? And we have to be careful because what's interesting is on one hand we make this argument about how libraries are indispensable. They're vital to democracy. They're fundamental to an educated electorate. My God, libraries are important. And people use us because,
if we're an essential nature to the democracy and education of this country, shouldn't we look at extrinsic motivation and say there's a compelling reason that you should go to the library on a regular basis?
Marketing is important, but marketing just assumes that we can trick people into coming when they didn't know that we were there in the first place. Let's make them come here. I really think it hurts. So, that's facilitation. The last one I want to talk about is that if you look at the mission statement, that the mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in our communities. There are really two major parts to that mission. The second part, facilitating knowledge creation in our communities, we just dealt with.
And that is completely focused on the member, on the community, external to us. Meaning that we partner with our members to make that happen. That what's very important is we co-own that process with our members. Their success is our success. Their failure is our failure. But they get to control what we do. Should we offer collections? Ask the user. Should we build a new building? Ask the community. So it's all about them, right? The universe hat is squarely on their head. The universe hat, by the way, an invention out of our household. It means that when one of us comes home, my wife or my kids, and we just had a lousy day, we get to own the universe hat for 10 minutes, the universe revolves around us. 99.9% of the time, the member is wearing the hat. That 0.1% is ours. This first part of the mission is an ethical counterbalance to the second. It says that the community can act all at once, but there are certain things that the library will not do. So, the comment, once again, picking on Ann Arbor, because I'm here. You probably know this one. The comment card that came in was that the library could be better because it needs more
prostitutes and free pie.
Prostitutes and free pie. Now, the library is allowed to say, No. Because you have to counterbalance the views of the community, because you have ethical responsibilities, because you have values. But that's very important because what it means is that you have a perspective on right and wrong. And that's a very different thing. So now that we've gotten rid of the phrase recorded knowledge, next one you kill. Unbiased. Kill it. Now people aren't going to necessarily be willing to get rid of that one. But I want to tell you why I think that we are not unbiased, nor are we ever unbiased, nor can we be unbiased, nor should we be unbiased. And it comes by showing you lots of dots. Let's say that you put up a collection online. Right? So you have a bunch of documents, you're going to put them online. Each one of these colors represents a different one of those documents. Scanned images, whatever you want. Now, when you put them online, do you simply throw them up randomly, or do you organize them somehow? Put them in alphabetically, you put them in chronological order, you order them, right?
This is what the librarians do, information organization.
But I would argue that by doing that, by providing an order, you have shown a bias. You have shown a value. You have shown a common. Now, I want to be really clear here. How does that concept of the librarian shaping information, which shapes perception and shapes views, jive with my first comment about letting the community have a conversation and develop their own knowledge? There's something that calls a pressure for participation. Our communities, our members, are seeking to learn. They're seeking to develop knowledge. We know that they're doing this through conversation. And we know that a conversation involves two parties which both have to contribute. Right? You can't have a conversation one way, or it's a monologue, or it's a lecture. Right? So, we have a role, and they have a role. But what they want to do is when you learn something, you shape how that works. When you walk out from this, and someone asks you, what did Dave talk about? Every one of you will have a different perception of what I talked about. Now, most of the time, functionally, it'll come out relatively the same. But it's not exactly the same. And so at one point, the reactive panel, I will guarantee you, will get into a fight about what I meant. And they'll ask me, and I'll get into a fight about what I meant. And between us, we'll all walk away and go, whatever. Right? But the point is, that pressure for how to organize it is on us on a regular basis. We want to comment. We want to organize. So what if, instead of just putting this online the way we want to see it, we allow people to reorder? And so one user comes in and says, no, that's the proper order. And another user comes in and goes, no, that's the proper order. This and that and this. What's amazing is our system should allow other people to explore this. So when you get the catalog and you do a search, who ordered the results of the catalog? By the way, I would love to say it was you, the librarian, but the truth is it was the vendor you purchased the machine from. But we won't go there right now.
Why not allow them all? And people go, oh, but they don't make noise. Right? So it used to be when we talk about cataloging and building systems, we talk about noise reduction.
Your job is to reduce noise.
The answer is no.
Add noise. You know. Just like our libraries have moved from quiet buildings to loud rooms to loud buildings to quiet rooms, our catalogs have not kept pace. We need to look at our online systems and say, how can we allow this noise to happen? And you go, but Dave, they'll never find anything, it'll be garbage. And I say to you, right now, as we see, 10,000 conversations are simultaneously occurring in this room. But you need technology like this in order to find it. Cell phone calls, radio signals going through, television signals going through your body, all this stuff right now. But with the use of technology, those digital signals, we can filter for just the conversation we want. Not only that, we can order them by one. When we're driving in, we listen to radio stations, we go, this one belongs here, this one belongs here, irregardless of where it is on this radio spectrum. By using technology, we can allow multiple simultaneous conversations to occur, and people can say, well, show me the comments just by the professor, show me the comments just by the student, show me the comments just by this person or that person. And over time, what happens is, we're going to start building ruts in the road. Right? So this is the idea that when you walk onto any university campus, you always see a beautiful lawn with a trail in the middle that people said,
I don't think that sidewalk works with
it. Well, we can let those trails happen. And then what we can do is we can have systems that can expose it and say, you know, if you started at point A, you probably want point B, and then point B and point C, and we can allow these to exist simultaneously and say, this is an order. This is sort of the popular order. But that doesn't negate the fact that there are multiple orders. Here's the original order. Which one do you want? And what I'm going to argue to you, and it's really hard to explain the value systems for dots, the fact that you did the bottom influenced strongly how the top ended up. You shaped that conversation. When you engage your members, you are not unbiased. Every move you do shapes it. The fact that someone comes up and asks me a question, and I'm a white, bald male, shapes that conversation. The fact that when someone asks me a reference question and I either do this first or this first shapes that conversation. We shape it. Our values say that in shaping it, we must be considerate of how we do it. So what are the values that guide us? First, learning. Everything we do about learning. You catalog a book, you're about learning. You answer a reference question, you're about learning. You lock the door at night, you're about learning. You sweep the floors at night, you're about learning. Everything we do is about learning. Openness. When we do our process, we do it with transparency. We do it so that people can see what we do. Now, not everyone is an environment where openness goes to the universe. It's openness within a community. I had someone talk to me about being in the Defense Technical Information Center. Openness consists of being really wide open with people with the right clearance. But openness is at least a value that we can strive for. Intellectual freedom and safety. Not only do we believe that knowledge is created through conversation, there is a corollary that as librarians, in whatever setting we are, we believe that the best knowledge is created through the richest conversation, the most informed conversation. And I want you to be very clear that that concept of being wide open, providing multiple views on things, is a value that has been faculty. So, under the first Bush administration and Clinton administration, there was a concept in the U.S. Department of Education called a reflective teacher. And the idea was, we want a classroom teacher to give them as much information as possible. We're going to put the fire hose right into their classroom. But we're going to prepare the teacher by teaching them about curriculum development, evaluation. We're going to teach them how to sort through that. The second Bush administration comes in and says, this is nuts. Teachers don't have the time. People don't understand it. We are going to give them only the good stuff into their classroom. Both of those would tell you that they are being intellectually honest and that they are in fact presenting sort of the best information, but both of those have a value system behind them. I would argue that librarians are on one side of that value equation that we need to know.
Intellectual safety is not only do we provide you with this different view, but we respect you in doing it. We are allowed to give you multiple perspectives, and when you come to share multiple perspectives, you will not feel threatened or in any way marginalized because of it. And intellectual honesty, not unbiased. You are biased. You are biased. You are biased. You are just smart enough to admit that you are biased. So I had this argument with my advisor, Mike Eisenberg, and he used to say, librarians should basically build the next Google. He called it Google. Leave it alone. And he said, they should do it. Now they should do it. They should pick only the good websites to search against.
And I said, oh, my. I said, that's not true.
This librarian just trained to find good information. I said, ooh. I said, we don't train librarians to find good information.
And everyone's happy to hear that. He starts saying, well, maybe you should charge the library science program and see if you can say that.
We teach you to find good information for a given question, or a given context, or a given problem. When a reporter walks into your library and asks for good websites on hate groups using the web to recruit new members, Ku Klux Klan website, good information. Eighth grader, looking for after school activities, not so much. We have perspectives of what we think are good. By and large, librarians tend to publish materials to certain publishers that are more credible than others. That's good. We can help save time with the user. But we also need to be intellectually honest in saying, but there are other perspectives here. That's not being unbiased. That's being intellectually honest. As a scholar in library science, how many studies do you think I'm going to report out and publish to talk about how libraries should go away? Not too many. I have a bias. But when I go and prosecute that research, when I look at it, I use terms like validity, reliability, quantitative method. I ensure that my comments are at least honest and that I can admit that before you read the results. Now, what's important to know about these is they are really the thing that separates us from all the other information agents working in our space. Search engines know about knowledge. Search engines know about facilitation. Search engines do, Google with Blogger and on YouTube, and such, doing more for broadcasting users' information and creating communities than they ever could. But this is what makes us uniquely important within our communities. This is something that the commercial forces can never do. The send a text to me and I'll send you an answer, because we know the communities. We marry the values of the community with our professional value to create something that's a force for improvement within our communities. Google talks about doing no evil. We should talk about getting rid of evil. We should talk about improving our communities. That's a proactive view. So what are my takeaways? Then we'll open up to questions. Number one, librarianship is all about knowledge, not stuff. Books, CDs, DVDs, these are tools that we use for our ultimate goal, which is knowledge. Can I envision a library that has no collection? Absolutely. Are some of you probably working in situations where you're a library without collections? Absolutely. Can I envision a library? Meg Bacchus is a great librarian at our NOPL office, and she has the idea of creating a manufactured library. And what she wants to do is fill a workspace full of things like drill presses and saws and all sorts of stuff, and experts to teach you on it, so that when you have that craft project, you don't come in and say, I want to build a planter, and find a book on building a planter. You'll build the damn planter. That's a library. Why? Because she is facilitating knowledge creation with these values within our community to improve the community's ability to manage itself. That knowledge is created through conversations, either conversations with ourselves, conversations among friends, colleagues, librarians, communities, societies. That since librarians are in the knowledge business, they're in the conversation business. And what is your community talking about? How do you evaluate it? How do you understand it? How often are you out in the community? And what role do you play within that community? Conversations take two strong interacting voices, including between the librarian and the community. You have a voice. You have an impact. Realize it, recognize it, and use it. That librarians are not neutral. They co-own, co-shape, and have equal responsibility in the success of our patrons. I have seen many librarians be terrified about things like mid-stage accreditation and re-accreditation of universities, because they sit there and they say, they don't want to know our numbers. They want to know the students' numbers. They don't want to know how many volumes we have or a circulation count or number of databases. They want me to figure out how answering a records question led to a B in home economics or whatever it is. Yeah. Because that's the ultimate goal. It's not, like the famous line about you guys with the most stuff wins. This is not the game we're in. Because one, you're dead. And that was not the ultimate goal of starting to collect the stuff. Okay? So what I want to remind you is that the mission, your mission, your personal mission is not collection, not organization, it's not stuff. It's facilitating. The mission
that you are on to improve society to facilitate knowledge creation within your community.
But that has requisite missions.
It comes from our desire and importance of service. We seek to serve. We have a desire to make the community better and to solve the community's needs. And I don't care if you're in a corporate library or a medical library or a public library or a school library or a library consultant on your own, whatever, you seek to serve. And you seek to lead. Oftentimes, if we believe that there is improvement within the community, we cannot stand idly by and let it pass by. We must step up to the bat. We must be an active voice within our community, not sit back and say, we're going to let that one slide. We have an obligation within the community to lead the community, not simply sit back. We are members of the community, and as such, we have a vested interest in its improvement. And we have an equal obligation to innovate, to look up from our trees and see the forest and to imagine new things. And that obligation to innovate doesn't stop with your job title. If you're a library aide, you should innovate how you shelve a book. If you're a reference librarian, you should innovate the resources you bring to it. If you're a director, you should innovate. Everyone within the organization should innovate. Think about it. Libraries are in the knowledge business. What is knowledge? Knowledge is learning and changing worldviews. It's improvement. That means that you're in the innovation business. Libraries are conservative places of sit back thought. Libraries are places of change and radical change and innovation. And that means every one of our jobs is not only to foster that innovation, but to model that innovation. So, what I want to say to end it is that this is our time, and we get to choose it. This isn't a Google's going to put us out of business conversation. This isn't a NextGen conversation. This isn't a Library 2.0 conversation. This is a conversation about librarians taking control of our future. And we can do it. We have brilliant people in this profession. But everyone here is a part of that. Everyone here can be brilliant in doing this. It's all of our responsibilities, and it's our obligation. And it's not something that people are going to do to us. It's something that we're going to step up. This place, where we are, right here, right now, underneath this concrete slab is dirt and mud and rock. It's the same stuff that's all over the world. This place is not special. There's nothing that came down and said something important is going to happen here. The palaces in Europe, or the castles in Europe, did not come by some divine appointment to them. People chose that place. What makes a place and a time historic and event-driven are when people do something with it. We can choose to make this place, this state, this city, this country, this time, the time of beginning to mold the libraries and librarians. This time, we need to stand up and say, as noble people, as people who are powerful, as people who are honest, as people as vital and important to this society as any other group, we will not sit by and let libraries go quietly in the night. We will not let us sit by and let the civic discourse degrade. We will not sit by and stand for ignorance and stand for meanness within our community. We will change the world. We get to choose the time. We get to choose the place. And this is it. And it's your job and my job to do it together. Thank you very much.
Wow.
So how do you really feel? Yeah. All right. We do have some time for questions, and as moderator, I'll take the to ask the first question. You present a fairly radical view of what librarians ought to be doing. So I'm wondering, what are the implications for education of librarians? Not to put you on the hot seat or anything, but what are you doing at Syracuse to lead in this direction for the upcoming generation of librarians?
Let me just pick on two points I think library science education is good. First is global one, which is we need to look at library education instead of being an event, stretch it out to a true career long activity. I think we need to look at undergraduate degrees in librarianship, I think we need to look at doctorates in librarianship, and I think we need to look at decent offerings for continuing education. One of the things is that librarians are not starved for continuing education opportunities. We just don't know how often to fit together. In New York, we just have implemented within the public library certification, we had it within the school library certification, of continuing education requirements for recertification. I think that's a good trend, as long as it's supported, because if you're going to say you need to do it, then you're not going to win. So that's number one, because I think the idea that 2.5 years at the beginning of your career prepares you for the rest of your life is just insane. Number two, we need to, just like I said, the librarians need to get outside of the library to start working with their communities. Library students need to get outside of a relatively friction-free learning environment. What that means is, I get librarians and I sign them, come up with a brand new record service. Someone goes and writes, and then they hand me a paper, and I go, oh, that's a great paper. And meanwhile, you would be sitting on typing. Well, I know that's a very good time. People forget about this side, right? My paper. That's a frictionless environment that we need to put them right in your faces. Not as apprentices. This is not an apprenticeship program. We teach someone to be exactly like us, but we bring them into real situations, real identity. And we do this partially with internships, but we need to do it with every class, where every class is a project. And that is your responsibility, your folks, who really need to come into our classroom, physically or virtually, to review and help us with that time. So that's just two major aspects to it.
Questions? Keith?
I guess I have a question about, you talked about facilitation, you talked about knowledge. Can you emphasize the relation? I am an academic member of the university, and I foster is really small now. I would say that as a librarian at the university, I facilitate knowledge discovery. But I see at the university that the disciplinary faculty facilitate, if you will, knowledge creation in their discipline. And to discover information does require knowledge, because it requires, as you point out, language. And to search for, to discover what other people say requires a dialogue, use language to find what other people say. But I see my role as the role at the traditional, I've been doing this for 30 years, as a discovery role, and that the creation role, what you do with the ideas of others, is, from my perspective, in the ballpark of the psychologist, the biologist, the historian, and I do facilitate discovery, which is real work, it requires real knowledge engagement, language engagement. So I guess it sounds so dynamic to say you facilitate knowledge creation, but to me, that isn't what I, as a librarian, do. It's this discovery role of bringing together the artifacts, the records of other people who've been blessed from every breed with those who have questions. So I can get them to discover what other people have thought, have said, have sung, but what they do with that, how they develop that, comes in my world from the disciplinary faculty who are the creators of knowledge and shape the creation of knowledge for the students in their classroom.
So let's parse two words.
Okay.
I think we're probably really talking about different things.
I don't want to. I really embrace
it. Right, yeah. So let's just clarify. This is, by the way, that we're negotiating language coming with the Greek standard. First of all, when you talk about discovery of knowledge, I see that as a process of facilitation.
Right.
Absolutely. And that is a vital, and that's what I want to be clear about. That one, I think librarians do create knowledge on their own because you're human beings and you can't help it. But the other is that facilitating that is bringing people to those conversations, which means we need to find out where they are, we need to find out how to access them, and all this. Absolutely. What I think is the one quibble that I would have is that I would argue that you don't get to stop there. And that doesn't mean that you have to make sure people absorb it, but you do have to understand the process of them absorbing it, or else you're not going to do a good job by exposing. You know, I can
remember the days when we used to talk about libraries and the best search engines?
Stop it. You're not. Do you really want to be in the job of providing 30,000 mostly irrelevant things within 5 seconds? This is not a competition you want to get into. right? And what's interesting is, have you ever found that those sort of really proactive graphic libraries chase a paper out of the library instead of throwing things at it? My point of that is they're not actually at that point, they lost the facilitation role. They're now in sort of their own, you know, world. They're doing it for themselves at that point. And part of what I say about knowledge creation is I think librarians have an obligation to stop and understand that that absorption process, even be aware of and be able to evaluate that absorption. And by the way, absorption is the wrong word, I just realized I'm saying this. It limits the creation process on the part of the members. So you get 50 articles you put through before. And I agree. It's discovery process, it's facilitation. I would argue in that process you are learning about the resources you're doing as you need. You put that before a paper. You put that before a member. Does your obligation stop there? Or do you have an increased obligation to have that 50 items make sense to that member?
To have those items as meeting a need of, if you will, a member, they have to make sense first. So it's not a matter of putting stuff there. It is facilitating the discovery using language of materials that match the original
plan.
So it has to make sense.
Right. And so when the member...
This is my item.
So when a student is reading these papers, this is also a therapy. When they're reading the papers, and they're building their understanding that was written out of the psychology department, the biology department, these professors, they're creating knowledge within their own head, right? There's a scope question. Right? I know, you're talking about, like, I as a faculty member, and one of my jobs is to create knowledge about unique original knowledge of library science for the community. When I'm reading a book, I'm creating knowledge, but it's made just for me, or for my friends, or for people. But that's still a knowledge creation process. Anytime I change my worldview, I create knowledge. And so I think it's a semantic question about what scope is. Do you as a librarian feel like you have to come up with a brand new original stuff that no one has seen before? No, I don't think so.
No, it's bringing the reader, if you will, into the old language, to this array of artifacts that they have to interpret certain.
Right, and that process of from a reader's perspective, that process is a knowledge creation process.
Okay, so it is then to me, it's the knowledge at my level of discovery, using language to discover. Materials, and again, yes, it's semantics when I say at this point as a librarian, that's when I'm out of the picture. It is then the disciplinary person who helps shape. I mean, the reader themselves, of course, has to do the knowledge creation to realize that something's even a need that they have.
Right.
So this is real high level stuff.
Yeah.
It excites me. That's what I do.
Right.
But at that point, when I can facilitate the reader. Using words to say, I was thinking of trying to find something related to this, and they actually knew themselves that they found it.
Yes.
I don't, at that point, we can semantically say they created knowledge. But in the university setting, I'd say, as a librarian, I've done my role to facilitate this discovery, this linkage of these resources. But then I'm asking what they do, what they create with that, how they go and implement this, how they go and do new things. Is where the disciplinary person goes. So I have very high
respect. And I would argue that,
but it's the word.
Yes, my last comment, good, and then be short comments, is just the fact that where your job stops and someone else's starts is a community decision.
Okay.
And so, you know, and I hope that there's a dialogue going on with your communities to figure out what that place is.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Richard?
Thinking about right now is this whole notion of creating a set of relevant information resources that are pertinent to our community. And it's very interesting because as you're talking about this, I mean, it's certainly encouraging me up to continue this conversation. We've got, you know, on one hand, what we want to do is have a responsible scholarly collection of materials. In other words, the responsible thing to do is take a look at what faculty have developed. In other words, work much like this. This is what we just have. But on the other side of it, we're thinking about the more mundane things, like the conversation things, the minutes of the meetings, and so forth, the experiences of people together and talking about topics of interest to them. So that's really, I think, it's something along the line of what you're talking about. I know when I go back to campus next week, I would certainly be bringing this up because we just started the 5-year planning process. I wish you'd been there last week. Because it would certainly charge people up to get creative about the future.
Thank you. Two quick questions about this institution possibly. So that was a white knight that was going to save all academic libraries, and then we realized that we spot thesis or get thesis involved in that. One is that I think that institutional repository interfaces should look more like the public library of science information look like your panel. Because then we won't use it. If you want the faculty to use it, they understand certain language and certain norms. When they look at something, they're going to look for editorial, they're going to look for peer review, they're going to look for spotlights, they're going to look for disciplinary connections. That when you put something behind a plain Belgian core record that people can search against, they don't find. So I think that's one. And the other is the reward system. When I look at integrating when I look at a lot of the efforts to build institutional repositories, it's sort of like this augmented need of faculty to submit things, or it turns into mandates that have few zoomers. And where I think that the two areas that academic libraries should do to make institutional repositories work are one, you should build it into the research process of your research institution. You go and apply for a grant. You go through an office sponsored program. That office sponsored program should have as part of their checklist the grant application, and when you file NSF and report things, that part of institutional conformance, the regulatory mandates of the university, should include depository regulations. The other is tenure. This drives me freaking nuts. Academic librarians are missing this amazing opportunity that at 6 years after I get a career, I get to be x-rayed at no level to figure out what I've ever done in my life. And everyone knows when it's going to happen, and everyone knows what's going to be documented when it happens. Why is it that a reference library isn't knocking on my door the year before they're going to copy their tenure library? And by the way, I'm actually required to do citation analysis as part of your institutional policies. Because I called for tenure. And I said, I got a phone for tenure, I need to do a citation analysis. And the response from my academic library was, oh, great, if you come down and send your GA down in an hour, we can teach you what databases to search. So in an hour, we can teach you everything about, ready for this? Bibliometric analysis in an hour. Let me think for a minute. Is there a group that really sees as one of its core unique strengths, bibliometric analysis? Oh, that would be you. Imagine doing that analysis and doing all this, getting the data, and at the same time grabbing every single article you've ever published in your repository. And the best part is, if you do your job well, and they go get tenure, you're their hero. And you can do it like crap. Then you're fired, and you don't get mad about it. So, institutional repositories. One, they look like a conversation you want to reach, understand, interpret, and use the language back. Two, you need to engage in existing conversations, processes, and procedures to do it. I think tenure is a strong one, research is a strong one, but every university is going to be different in their missions, I understand. And so those are new processes. But, I agree. It's building our own cloud and sharing it.
Thank you, John.
You talked about I'm troubled by the term that you use by term memory. Are you talking about recall memory?
In a conversation, in past terms, a conversant, and once again, a conversant could be an individual, could be part of the individual,
can be a group, in which case memory is your external mindset. You build memory of the agreements that you've had, meaning that whenever you encounter new situations, you know, somewhere back in my life I learned that this was a class and so on. At that level, I came to that agreement when I was a kid, and my parents said, here, bring this. So things can be pretty early. But the idea is that we need to remember what we've already agreed to is in your head. Because you see, you don't do it perfectly by any means. And we run into situations where we have to renegotiate this. So, one, memory is, yes, within me, it's here. Within a group like this, it's the screencast I'm taking, it's some documentation, it's some artifact I'm producing. But even then, the artifacts you produce only vaguely resemble the real history we have, because you have it, right? You have a policy, you sit there and you go, but is there a policy? There is. That's not a policy. This is. So even by externalizing it, it doesn't mean it's 100% different. The other important part of memory, and the most important part, is that it is relational. So, I've done this before, I apologize if you've heard me before. Put your hand. I'm going to give you a word, I want you to think about what it means. Light. L-I-G-H-T. So, hands, how many people thought illumination? How many people thought not heavy? How many people thought set of legs? Good, no higher than answer. Now, the reason that that's interesting, right, let's go to the next one. Formula. Mathematical combination. Chemical combination. Can you get maybe to step not start with that? Parents, your grandparents. Last one. OMG. How many people got Omnimedia Group? Stop! Now, what's amazing about that is, think about what's happening. Your brain just did something really interesting. Your brain tried to figure out what something meant with almost absolutely no context. And it, with light and formula, it had lots of options. And it just cracked. With OMG, it had very few, maybe two. Maybe testing, maybe I am. But the point is, you knew what I'm about to do. The idea here is that by noting that things are relational, and they're uniquely relational to us, and I'll tell you, you said OMG, when you work for the OMG media group, they wouldn't have come up with OMG. That's important. Now, think about how we take the artifacts that are produced as a memory process, my books, like this, and how we organize them. We put them in slots. Now, the slots do represent a group's view of how they're organized, whether it's you, your Library of Congress, what have you. But they certainly don't represent everyone's view. Right, so my joke, way back when you look, I do get the reference. Right? Dewey had a perspective when he came out with the new decimal system. If you ever looked at the religion numbers, what's religion? 200s? Right, so 210, 20, 290s are all Christian. Right, and then everything else. Could there have been a perspective? Was maybe Melville a Christian? I don't know. So how we keep that memory is a representation of relations, and those relations represent our agreements, and they represent our longings together. So my point of memory is that, yes, for you and I, it's a neurological process, but psychologists would tell you that it's like relations, and when we externalize that and keep our memory over time, those become artifacts. They're not the actual memories of the individuals. But we often lose the fact that they are related themselves, and we lose a lot of that richness when we represent those, that memory, back to a community. I don't know if we're anywhere near. There's a great thing called source amnesia. And source amnesia is the way that we know librarians are freaks of nature. Because most of us, when we learn to come up with an agreement, we usually lose where we came up with that agreement over time. So in other words, the fact that I know that Mount Everest is this high, I probably read it somewhere, but I forgot it. Or as you point out, I'll make up where I learned it. It happens all the time. And we know in research, you ask someone, how did you find the fight? Reference letter, raise your hand. Pick on you. If I asked you, if I said, pick your last reference letter, All right, pick your last reference point. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes, what was your last reference point? No, I'm making
it. It was information about the
country. And how did you find the information you needed?
I went on to Wall Street.
Why did you go on to Wall Street? There's a great new change in his life. The idea is that when you ask someone to recreate an event, you are recreating it. And as human beings, we work to make it sound better than we want to. Right? So the truth is that's probably why I did it, but it might have been because well, that was the first day of this. Or as an unconscious effort, we go back to that bias. You're right. When people create and recreate memories, there are issues. And in fact, one of the roles of the librarian as the stewardship notion, one of our obligations, is to correct the memory, or at least, but we also have to understand that by housing it, cataloging it, organizing it, certainly, we also do influence. Very good.
Sure. Nancy, do you have a question?
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And so when I ask things like, I like Harry Potter, more books like this. Is it children's fiction I want more books of? Is it magic stuff I want more books of? When for me, more like this about Harry Potter is the DK Encyclopedia of Legos, the Star Wars vehicles, and the Star Wars universe, because those are the books that I really bonded with my 8-year-old son at one time. So, but that's me. And well, we can create lists of those. As you see Amazon, they have all these lists and things. But even that doesn't tell you the connective tissue between them. And so you're right. A lot of what we need to do in our information organizations is go to our communities and say, how do you organize this? Help them make sense of that process. And then, yeah, expose it back to them. That's that pressure of participation. But you said it better.
Right. I think one last question. Was it Ray? Do you have a question?
Yeah. You were mentioning and one of the goals in information literacy had been to come up work ourselves out of the gap. You see that as a valid goal for the facilitation to remain in the conversation.
I think that our job will be over when we create no more knowledge. And hopefully that's not anytime soon. Some if a little persuasion might say this. No, the answer is it's a legitimate question. And if you define yourself as tool, as functional, searching to find collections, you're absolutely right. I remember early on sitting at ALA Midwinter and showing there's a big push for virtual reference. And showing the reference line, the ACR reference statistics, line going down, 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 down. And all the reference arguments went, and we were saying that. And then this library director got up and said, no, that's a sign of success. You guys asked me for more money for training. You guys asked me for more money for better systems. And we succeeded. We took the most expensive operation library down for the first half of the experience. And we have minimized the cost. And if you define yourself as helping to access that collection, you get it. But the answer of information literacy is that is a process, and it's a new process each time. And so teaching that process but also facilitating that process. I would argue, way back to our original question, for example, that when a faculty member develops knowledge, in that classical sense,
librarians be either, but oftentimes what librarians in academic environments become are shovels and catchers. When someone comes and says, I'm doing research on topic X with a shovel, well, I looked at this, here's some more. And then you let them go off and do something further. And wait for them to publish something, give it away to Elsevier so we can buy it back. And that's where the catcher's been. You wait for the to get the result. So you shovel in the feed and wait for the maneuver at the end. Right? But what about when that person's doing that process? Are they going to have trouble disseminating to other people? Are they going to be working collaboratively with other people? Do they understand how to facilitate collaborative conversations? Anyway, that's a key skill of ours. We're working in, within Syracuse, creating something called the Cyber Infrastructure Facility. God, I hate that term. But what it really means is a damn good science library. To work in places with lots of data where they don't work in the library with the questions, they work in the labs. And their job within the labs is to not only capture and organize the data produced as a result of the research, but to collaborate working with faculty all over the world, back and forth, communication effort, building institutional memory of that, helping them document the research, so that really, it's not they go off and do something brilliant. Librarians are helping them do something brilliant, and so when it comes time for budgets and evaluations, you know what happened? We did an NSF trial grant with four students. Three of them got hired before we finished the process. Paul Mandel, who used to be at the University of Rhode Island, tried this where he embedded one of his librarians. The lab came and hired her away from Paul Mandel. They were hungry for this within the research process because I'm a biologist, I'm a psychologist. I don't understand this discovery process and organization process, but increasingly I have to deal with it. Every grant that comes out of the National Science Foundation, almost everyone's going to throw a website. Who's better at throwing a website? The GA is going to figure out how to help us a faculty member who's not going to remember after 2 days in the book conference. For us! Right? This is where we can embed it in the knowledge creation, and there's the classic knowledge creation process that we can facilitate and be embedded in an academic setting. I would argue that for our public library folks, there are equivalents in the public library setting, from policy setting and regulation setting within the city government, looking at foundation work, looking at economic development agencies. These are places that we can embed ourselves to improve the society.
That's great. Thanks, David.